Well, quick report. Fuzz and I did something we haven't ever done before. We did a skeptics forum on a campus where we invited the atheist professors on the campus to critique our messages. So that was kind of fun. This is at the University of California, Davis. So Fuzz went up early. My time was a little bit stressed. So he was up there for 2 days. I was up there for a day. But when he went up, he gave a lecture first to the faculty at lunchtime, and then did an evening lecture for the students, and that was followed by my coming the next day and doing another lecture for the faculty. And then we had this campus-wide event, this Skeptics Forum. And the largest auditorium they had there seated 1,300, and we packed the place out. But about 100 people were turned away. And, you know, they really did pick the most famous of the science faculty they had there, a guy by the name of Andreas Albrecht, who is a really very well-known cosmologist, theoretical astrophysicist. And I've actually quoted several of his papers in my books. He's had a hand in extending the applicability of the space-time theorems of general relativity and is well-known as a defender of the inflationary hot Big Bang model. Amazingly, he's an atheist. I mean, it's hard. I can't imagine him writing those papers and still being an atheist. And then Dan Potter, who is an evolutionary biologist in plant biology, also very well known, another atheist. But the thing that struck Buzz and I is they were both nice atheists. I mean, and, you know, they kind of preface their talk by saying, you know, we are atheists, but we've got nothing against religion and don't want to offend people's religious sensibilities, and we're not trying to say that this is the only way, my way or the highway. So that's how they started off. But because they were so well known, and probably the other factor was they charged money for any outsider. If you were off campus, it was $5 to go, and everybody had to get a ticket, including the students and the professors. But if you were a student or a professor, you got a free ticket. If you were part of the support staff or the campus or the area community, you had to pay $5. I think that feeds into the student mentality. I mean, it's like they're getting something worth $5 for free, so they go. And we had about, I would guess, 900 to maybe 1,000 students, probably 50 to 100 faculty, and maybe about 300 community people, and as I said, about 100 or more were turned away. But it's something we're going to be doing I think it's Wednesday. Fuzz and I will be doing the same thing at the University of Illinois. And there we have a Nobel Prize winner representing the atheist side. So he's going to be presenting his own model on the origin of life. That should be quite interesting. And they have a famous physicist who will be responding. But the way it worked is I spoke for 23 minutes and Fuzz spoke for about 25 minutes. I focused on the origin of the universe and the design of the universe. He focused on the origin of life, the design of life molecules, and the origin of humanity. Now, since he only had 23 and 25 minutes each, we really had to condense things down. And that was something that both Fuzz and I were concerned about. Here we got these famous atheist science professors responding to us, and we really don't have much time to lay out anything. So we just had to leave huge holes in our presentations. And that's part of the problem, is the organizer said, we want you to cover all the sciences. We'll cover all the sciences in 50 minutes or less is quite a challenge. But what really surprised us is that when it came to the, because the faculty members had 40 minutes to respond to our talk. And I was expecting, because I had to leave out the whole thing about the multiverse. And I knew that Andreas Albrecht was a real fan of promoting the multiverse. But when it came his turn, he didn't bring it up at all. And he didn't challenge any of the science that I presented, not one bit. Several students told me afterwards he was taking notes throughout my talk and nodding his head every time I made a comment. So it's like he was agreeing with everything I said. And, I was kind of waiting for the rebuttals to come. But he probably knew that I had PowerPoints prepared for those rebuttals. So I don't know what. He just let it all go. And the same thing happened with Fuzz, because we were expecting, with all the holes he left in his talk, that Dan Potter would go after him. It didn't happen. And instead what happened was both of these atheists took the approach of going after the philosophy of science. And, you know, the big theme was coming into it is that, you know, what you guys are presenting is not science because it's not testable, it's not falsifiable, it's not predictive. But what we did in our 48 minutes was just lay out many examples of how our model could be falsified, how it does make successful predictions of future scientific discoveries, and how it's, you know, obviously testable. And so they kind of abandoned that approach, and they developed a new strategy on the spot, which was to redefine science again. And their definition of science that they try to promote is, you know, what you're hearing, you know, Rana and Ross present is not science because it doesn't produce experimental results with error bars. And what was interesting to me is here's Andreas Albrecht, a theoretical astrophysicist, and none of his work ever produces measurable results or error bars either. And therefore, he would have just excluded himself from the scientific discipline. I wasn't nasty enough to suggest that he should join the philosophy department, but what we did point out, however, was that what you saw repeatedly in our model is that although we don't produce experimental results with error bars, that's not the intent of model design. Rather, what we do is we present an explanation that produces limits, namely that the observations, if our model is correct, should fall within two limits on a particular parameter. And I said, you know, isn't that science? And obviously that's what Andreas Albrecht does in his own work. I wound up writing him a letter because he kept insisting all the way through his 40 minutes, you know, Ross, what you're presenting is not science. It's not science. Where's your error bars? Show me your error bars. And I kept saying, well, what we have is limits and boundary conditions. And, you know, that is just as much science as, you know, producing experimental results and error bars. Comment? Well, one thing Fuzz pointed out in his response to the questions was, you know, no one really has a rigorous definition of science. We kind of all know what it feels like, but trying to define it is kind of like trying to define a species of life or trying to define what life is. You're dealing with something that's rather complex. But, you know, if we're really going to define science as something that only produces experimental results where you can do laboratory experiments and with error bars on them, that eliminates the entire discipline of astronomy, both observational and theoretical, and eliminates all of theoretical science. That would all be isolated. And I don't think there's too many at UC Davis that would be willing to entertain such a narrow definition of science. But what we found interesting was that was the only way they could defend their atheism. On the other hand, you know, one of the things I did do in my talk was lay out the space-time theorems of general relativity, showing how scientific measurements can actually demonstrate the existence of a causal agent beyond matter, energy, space, and time. So, but there again, he said, where's the error bar on that causal agent? So, but that's what kind of amused both Fuzz and myself is that, you know, we were expecting them to respond with a scientific rebuttal, and all we heard were philosophical rebuttals. And that fact, that happened when we went to the students and had them ask questions at the microphone. It was all, you know, philosophical philosophy of science issues. Some of it was biblical too. That encouraged me that a lot of students started asking questions about the Bible. So, very successful evening. We didn't have anybody yell at us. So, usually you get a few of those, but that didn't happen. Yes. True, and we'll see how it goes at the University of Illinois. So it's also kind of in the middle of the farm area. Right. Well, there were a lot of atheist students there because when Andreas Albrecht kept saying, you know, this isn't science because it doesn't produce measurable results and error bars, he kept getting claps from a little cheering group right in front of him. So, although Fuzz reminded me after it was all over, I wasn't aware of it, but when I went up to the microphone, I was the first one to speak. There was some kind of whoop, whoop, whoop cheer coming out from the audience. We must have had some of our folks there, too. I didn't even know what that was all about, but Fuzz says, oh, no, that means that they like you when they do that. So, I wasn't sure. I don't know whether it got recorded or not. So, I think that'll get recorded. It's possible it got recorded. I'm not sure. So, But this is the first of several of these things we'll be doing in university campuses. We have one scheduled at Ohio State in April. So, well, let me give you an example of what he was talking about. Let's suppose you live in Monrovia, and we try to measure the population of Monrovia, but it's hard to get everybody home at the same time. There's homeless people there, a few, I don't know, maybe none. And so what you do is you come up with a measurement of the population of Monrovia. That would be, say, 35,000 plus or minus 500, which means that with some reasonable degree of assurance, we know that the population of Monrovia is between 34,500 and 35,500. So we kind of get a range of where the population would lie. But if you were to go house to house with thousands of census takers and do that repeatedly day after day for a few months, you could probably get a measurement of the population of Monrovia that would be accurate to plus or minus 5 rather than plus or minus 500. So that's what they mean. And, you know, that's experimental science. And really what Andreas Albrecht was trying to do was define science as being limited only to experimental science. Whereas most scientists believe that there are three aspects of science. There's observational science, there's experimental science, and there's theoretical science. And that when you have a model that has support from theory, observations, and experiments, that's a good model. So these are three different ways that you could put to the test a scientific explanation. But, you know, for what it's worth, what Fuzz and I kept doing with the audience, both the professors and the students, was emphasizing all the different ways our model could be put to the test and showing them examples of upper and lower bounds. And they kept saying, well, you know, what scientific discovery would prove the Christian faith wrong? And, you know, what you're really dealing with in the campus situation is this idea that Christians are utterly dogmatic. And, you know, we're not going to make any adjustments no matter what the evidence shows. So what we did is we laid out for them discoveries that scientists could make that would be fatal to Christianity. And a good example of that would be, say, if we were able to prove in a definitive fashion that the universe is infinitely old and had no beginning and there is no causal agent beyond matter, energy, space, and time, I would argue that would be fatal to the Christian faith. It would be really difficult to sustain any kind of theology of Christianity if that were proven to be incorrect. And then there are discoveries that would be corrosive to the Christian faith. For example, if we were to prove that the origin of humanity dates back a million years instead of 50,000 years, that would be damaging or corrosive to the Christian faith, but not necessarily fatal. I mean, you could kind of build an interpretation, a difficult one, I would imagine, of Genesis 1 and 2, that could accommodate that, and you know, people have done that. And then there are those discoveries that would simply be adjustments to the model. Know, something that could be well accommodated, whether it's true or not true. And so we just kept giving them repeated examples of how that could work out and examples of boundary conditions. You know, one that the students really liked is that we laid out, well, you know, based on our creation model, and there are more than biblical creation models than just the one we offer, but in ours, we would interpret the scriptures as predicting that Adam and Eve would be the ancestors of all humanity, so we would predict that the genetic evidence should show that we're descended from one woman and one man from one region. And that gives you boundary conditions that you can put to the test, and moreover a date, that it can't date any earlier or later than 10,000 years ago and can't date any earlier than 100,000 years ago. So if you were to prove that, the human species has only been here for 2,000 years, that would be rather corrosive to our model. Or if you were to prove, rather surprising for everybody. or if it were, let's say, a million years, that would be quite damaging to our model. Or if you were to prove that the human species actually originated in three different continents from large populations, that would also be damaging. So, but Fuzzman's talk did have about 3 minutes where he outlined the scientific evidence for why it's one location, one woman, one man, and 50,000 years ago. So that's a good example where it could be put to the test. So anyway, appreciate your prayers. Yeah. It was billed to the students rather unfortunate. It was called Evolution versus Intelligent Design. And, you know, Fuzz and I really were not trying to defend intelligent design against evolution. And I was a little concerned that the standard intelligent design inferences would be debated. But fortunately, they weren't. The two professors had read our books. The biologists had read right through the Origins of Life book, and the cosmologists had read right through the Creator and the Cosmos. And they were told that they could also respond to anything in the books as well as our talks. And we found it interesting they chose not to respond to anything in our books. They let it all go. So it'll be interesting to see who sponsored this. Campus Crusade for Christ was the sponsor. And actually, the $5 a head helps. Campus Crusade has no money, at least for student outreaches again. We literally had to do this event for free. They covered our expenses. But the $5 paid for the auditorium and paid for our travel. So we did, and they sold quite well. In fact, we were rather surprised because, you know, usually when you do a thing which is predominantly students, they clean all of your free stuff off the tables. As much free stuff as you bring, they will take. And they typically don't buy anything that has a cover charge of a dollar or more. So... But they bought a lot of books, particularly the Asian students. Asian students were the ones that were primarily buying the materials. Question? Yeah. Well, Newsweek, just a couple of days ago, released a major piece on intelligent design. In fact, last night I just jotted off a letter to the editor. We'll see if it gets published. And it's all because there are major court cases that are brewing, especially in Pennsylvania. It's the first time that a school board has mandated the teaching of intelligent design rather than simply allowing it. It's now required. And this has led to a number of atheists in Pennsylvania filing suit, and it is going to go to court. So we're predicting that the intelligent design people will lose. So, well... What concerns me, there's been four court cases in the past 3 years. There's been one in Kansas, one in Ohio, one in Georgia, now there's one in Pennsylvania. And in each case, we're winding up with less freedom to teach creation from a biblical perspective than what we had before. In other words, we had just kept quiet and done nothing. We'd be better off than we are now. And in every single case, the younger creationist model crops up. And, of course, the science teachers say that's something we can't allow in the classrooms. And they wind up going overboard and ruling out stuff far beyond than just the young earth creationist model. And so we wind up having greater restrictions than what we had before because Christians weren't wise in how they proceeded with this. And I think this is especially going to be the case in Pennsylvania because, you know, although... almost all the intelligent design leaders are old earth in their perspective. Those that are pushing for these court cases and school board decisions are predominantly young earth. In the case of Pennsylvania, they've yet to interview a parent or a school board member that's pushing for this mandated intelligent design that's not young earth. So naturally, the ACLU is going to jump on that big time. So we're not. We probably should. If we had someone like you that could volunteer to make that happen, that'd be terrific. So, yeah, I mean, part of the problem is that we're finding ourselves really busy. I'm behind on two of my book projects. And, you know, just even trying to get this thing out to the Newsweek was something I just had to squeeze in. So a lot of our stats is you just got to take time off and do this. But when I do that, I get behind on my work. So and we're not like the Discovery Institute. The Discovery Institute spends most of their time on the political and legal front. We're spending most of our time building our model. So we think that's what we should do, given the kind of people we are. We're not lawyers. We got a couple of philosophers, but we're predominantly trying to build this. And, you know, scientists typically don't do well in that venue, but that day may come. What we've told the people in all of these situations is that we're available. In fact, we almost got to testify in Ohio. But what happened was a number of younger creationists, intelligent design people heard that we were coming, and they quickly closed the doors on us coming in. They said the last thing we want is, because they were worried that if we came in, we would make it religious. Our whole point is, by making the model religious, you make it scientific. If you fail to make it religious, you don't have a scientific model. Which is basically what I'm writing to Newsweek, is saying that, you know, we need to open this up, and the Supreme Court's given us the right to do that. Yeah. Oh, it's pending right now. The suit has already been filed, and the state court has said they will hear it, and it's also likely to go to the U.S. Supreme Court. So I'm kind of hoping that the Christians there will not let it go to the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court has already got a really strong statement that works well in our favor. And if we push too hard based on this Pennsylvania thing, we could wind up having that statement reversed, which I think would be really deadly. Some people have done that. I don't know whether they've actually got into their hands. So, but yeah, someone actually did do that for us. But that is no guarantee that these people have actually, exactly. Their law clerks might, right. So, just so that you're all aware, what the Supreme Court ruled in 1981 is that the creation equal access was deemed to be illegal because it violated the separation of church and state. However, the Supreme Court justices did not make that ruling until they first tested the creationist model on its scientific merit. And they brought in both non-Christians and Christians who were scientists, and all of them, without exception, testified that this model had zero scientific integrity and credibility. And they wound up writing a statement. They said, any model already has protected access in the public education arena as long as it has demonstrable scientific integrity and credibility, regardless of the theological implications. It basically said theology doesn't count if it has demonstrable scientific integrity. But because this model had no scientific integrity, they said the only basis on which we can judge it is its religious merits, and we look at it from a religious perspective, it appeared to them that it was a creation doctrine coming from a single denomination of the Christian community. They said on that basis, it does violate the separation of church and state, which is basically set in place to keep the federal government from legislating that everybody must belong or adhere to a single denominational perspective. And so they said, in other words, and I read the proceedings, the court was forced to apply the church-state clause because there was no other basis on which they could judge the merits of the case. They said there's no secular merit to this at all, there's no scientific merit, therefore we have to judge it on its religious merit. But if that wasn't the case, they said it would have been in regardless of its theological implications. They may be involved. There are a couple of Christian legal groups that are getting involved in this, but I'm not predicting that that's going to help much. Well, they will be advancing the intelligent design thing, but that's not going to go anywhere either, because the intelligent design movement has yet to identify where they stand on the age of the earth, the age of the universe, and the duration of life on earth. They've yet to make a stand on what they think about descent with modification. And they've yet to explain, or identify who the designer is and explain why the designer would operate that way. Because of those failings, they have no model, and therefore they're going to be stuck just like the young earth creationists, where they'll say, well, this has no scientific merit, we'll have to judge it on its religious merits, and on that basis, I predict they'll lose. Oh, we already have. It's called the Reasons to Believe Biblical Creation Model. It's called the Testable Creation Model, pardon me. And we call it the Testable Creation Model, in short. Well, I'll tell you something that happened at UC Davis, was several atheists came up to me afterwards and said, what we're proposing is just too radical and, to use your words, too arousing. And, this is going to make it difficult for Hindus and Buddhists to participate in science education, because what you guys are saying is that you can use science to put to the test. Because I spoke explicitly during the Q&A time about how Hinduism could be falsified. They predicted that the universe will go through cycles of beginnings and endings with a period of 4.32 billion years. And I said, you know, that's the three significant places. So if it proves to be 4.35, they're in trouble. And, you know, maybe we have measurements already that are accurate enough to show that it's not 4.32, and everybody laughed. but then the point was, well, you know, given this politically correct society in which we live, maybe we shouldn't even permit that to happen. And I says, well, what you're really suggesting is we need to cripple science in order to be sensitive to people who hold failed creation models. And I said, but, you know, notice that we don't allow teaching in science classrooms of hypotheses proposing that the Earth is flat. That's a highly religious idea. You can get into the flat Earth movement and discover that it's theologically based. But it seems like we have no problems offending people who believe in a flat Earth. And, you know, people, of course, say, well, that's not relevant today, how many people believe in a flat Earth. But it says, well, there are people, even here in California, who believe that the Earth is the center of the solar system, with the sun revolving around the Earth. And yet notice that we discriminate against that in the science classroom, and nobody feels bad about it. And it says, you know, here's Dr. Albright and myself. We're in the discipline of cosmology, and we don't feel too bad about offending the Buddhists and the Hindus. And even people from a Hindu perspective recognize that the scientific evidence is against their model. So why don't we just generalize that to everything? But there is this mood here within America that we have to be tolerant of everybody. And I would argue that if you're tolerant without being discriminatory against failed models, that in itself is an expression of intolerance. You know, you got to kind of carefully nuance that, and I tried to do that. But then what I discovered was I had this hornet of nests of students around me who are part of the gay and lesbian club. And suddenly we got off the topic of creation. Now we're on this other subject. So this is what's really going on. They're a little bit worried that if we start having testable models in creation evolution, then this could be applied to human behavior. And I said, well, you know, it could be. And well, we don't want that. Well, Fuzz spent about 10 minutes on the origin of life in his talk, and knowing that we had a professor there who was an expert in the origin of life. And he ducked that like the plague. I mean, we got no questions on the origin of life, either from him or the students. Well, I mean, what Fuzz and when I were talking about afterwards is, you know, it really is amazing that there were zero challenges on the scientific issues. I mean, if our model had no merit, then how come there's not a single scientific challenge? This is an event that went on till midnight. So we started at 7 o'clock, and we were there till midnight. And, you know, there were hundreds of students still there at midnight. Some started to leave at 11, but no challenges. Rather, we were dealing with things like, well, you know, if you're going to apply this to creation, what about the homosexual lifestyle? So, or, you know, what about these philosophy of science issues? So what that tells me is people are talking about the implications of our model, not the truthfulness of our model. Like they're accepting the fact that, yep, you guys are fairly representing the status of the data, and this presents serious challenges, and we want to talk about the implications of what you're talking about, or is there some way we can defend an atheist worldview in spite of this challenge that we're facing? Well, what they're proposing is we so narrowly define science, we don't have to talk about it. But in his opening remarks, Andreas Albrecht repeated Stephen Gould's separate magisteria. Says this is really how we should go about settling these creation evolution debates. We have two disciplines. We have religion and theology over here, and we have a science over here. Science deals with logic and facts and reality, and religion and theology, well, they don't, you know, they're a little nicer about it. They don't say it's wishful thinking. They say it deals with emotions and ethics. That's how they worded it. But, you know, I can kind of read what they're really implying. It deals with wishful thinking and myths. But it says, as long as we can keep these two groups apart, no problems. But I kept bringing up the point that you can't keep them apart. Everything in science has theological implications, and everything in theology has scientific implications, and we would do a disservice to both theology and science if we were to treat them as mutually exclusive disciplines. You know, it really helped to bring that point across. I said to the two professors, has there ever been this many students or community people come to a science lecture on this campus? And they said, no. And I said, well, what's the biggest attendance you ever had for a science lecture in the past? Well, they said, they had an intelligent design proponent come and drew 400. I said, but there again, we're talking about the integration of science and faith, weren't we? How about just a pure science lecture where that's not done, where we follow your paradigm of keeping science and theology completely separate? And he says, well, the best attended lecture we had was 250. I said, yes, but were the students required to attend that lecture? And he says, yes, they were. So in terms of an open lecture, they really couldn't give us any examples of, because I said, you know, give me a number. And I said, well, we can't give you one. In terms of an open lecture, which was free and not required. And so my whole point was, well, you know, even if you guys don't like what we're doing and you really want to defend your atheism, isn't this a great way to maybe resolve the science education crisis we're facing in America? This is a way to make science exciting and get people actually involved in learning more about the record of nature. And they said, well, we can't fault you on that one. So, and they're eager to do it again. So that's nice. 1,300 with 100 or 200 that were turned away. So that was good. Anyway, if you're wondering what all this stuff is up front here, my wife was raised in California, and we're going to Chicago. A good chunk of her staff are going to Chicago. I'll be there actually 10 days. And Kathy's going to be there 6 days. And she didn't have any warm clothing, but she knows some friends here at the church that do. So that's why all that stuff is here. I'm going to the Urbana campus, but also going to Wheaton College. We'll be at Lucent Technologies. And a couple of churches are having us speak. We tried to get into Fermi Labs, and we have some people there that are cosmologists and physics researchers there. They couldn't get us in because a guy in charge is an atheist. And we tried for 4 months to make that happen, but one guy stopped it. So, and we answered all of his objections, and he was worried that we were going to present the young earth model and said, no, we're not doing that. And he was worried about the intelligent design, so he said, that's not what we're all about. And again, he couldn't argue with any of our science, and he couldn't argue that this would be worthwhile. He said, I'm just not going to let it happen. But he did say, next time, I might. So if we go to Chicago again, he might do it, and some of his people are going to be going to the Willow Creek thing. That's the main reason we're going. Willow Creek Community Church is having us do a creation conference. So there'll be a few thousand of that, yeah. Lucent Technologies is the new name for Bell Research Labs. Yeah, we'll be there. At the Chicago office, right. I've actually spoken at Lucent before. And it drew a huge crowd, so they're eager to have us come back. And, you know, Fuzz is going to get to speak as well. So, yeah, I think it's the second largest of the Bell Research Labs. It's still, the New Jersey one is still the biggest. But, you know, Lucent has about 30,000 scientists that work for them at the PhD level. So it'll be, and they have a Christian club on campus, too, so that's nice. And they're the ones that are inviting us to come in. So... yeah, appreciate your prayers. And Kathy says that she hopes all this stuff will keep her warm. And I'm telling her she's bringing too much. So, you know, I think it's only going to be 0 degrees there. It's not that bad. So, well, what we've done is we've kind of field tested different names. And the one that seems to go down best with people who are atheists and agnostics is simply to call it a testable creation model. But in the church, we call it the Reasons to Believe Biblical Testable Creation Model. But in the secular arena, just simply the testable creation model. We felt it's important to put the word creation in there so they know that we're actually promoting a model that will challenge the reigning paradigms. So, and if it's provocative, that's great. So... well, you know, these two professors we had responding to us, they were specifically instructed to do whatever they could to shoot holes in our model, scientific holes in our model. And for 40 minutes, they didn't even take one shot. So, but we'll see what happens at Illinois. There'll be a different situation there, obviously. But again, it's two atheists. It'll be Wednesday. So... No. Wednesday, we're down in Urbana. That's 2.5 hours south of Chicago. So we're going to drive down, do the thing in Urbana, and then we're coming back up to... I'll be at Wheaton College on Tuesday. And then we're doing this conference, then we're speaking at Lucent and a bunch of other places. And then doing some media events, too. Yes. Lucent thing, I think we'll be doing the day we drive back. That'll be Thursday. That's the day we drive back from Urbana. So, and pray that the roads will all be open. So, I've been there before where it's been blizzards, and it's hard to get where you need to get to go. So, but fortunately, the weather right now isn't that bad. So, if it stays that way, we'll be in good shape. Okay. I don't know what to do. Let me give you a quick report on a scientific discovery, and then we'll get into Job 39. And this is relevant to what we're talking about. In the latest issue of Nature, there's the first ever study looking at biodiversity and extinctions, where they're looking at long periods of time. What's been done up to this date is to show that the survivability and the stability of species on planet Earth is highly dependent on how many other species share the habitat with them, which is what biodiversity means. And up till now, these studies have been limited in the range of number of species that have been investigated and the time scale, looking at hundreds of years. This group of ecologists decided to look at the last half billion years. And you say, well, how can you do that? They went after coral reefs, where we got good paleontological evidence of the past history of coral reefs. And there you're looking at thousands of species instead of just dozens of species like in these previous studies. And so they show that with more species being investigated and longer time scales, literally tens of millions and hundreds of millions of years, that they show that the relationship is strong. So what this paper proposes is that this is really a law of biology, that the stability and the survivability of species really does depend on biodiversity. The greater the biodiversity, the greater the stability, the greater the survivability, and it doesn't seem to matter whether we're talking a few species, a bunch of species, tens of years or hundreds of years or millions or half billions worth of years. It just really does seem to be a universal principle. And on that basis, I would argue that this provides a serious challenge to the evolutionary model. By the way, I was expecting this evolutionary biologist to propose this idea that we're all descended from a single bacterium that lived in the ocean 3.8 billion years ago. We didn't go there. And Fuzz was ready for him anyway. You see in our Origins of Life book, the origin of life is not our descent from one species. Rather, it shows that 3.8 billion years ago, you got dozens of different species of bacteria with several different metabolic pathways operating in those species. But this paper would explain why. Without the biodiversity, those species would go extinct. So if life evolved from a single species, that single species would have gone extinct before anything. Yeah, it would have gone extinct right away. You really do need all this diversity in order to keep anything alive. And now you've got the challenge of trying to explain, well, you know, how do you go from non-living matter to dozens of different species of life with radically different metabolic systems in place? And you know, that's becoming a more prominent challenge to the origin of life camp from a naturalistic perspective, the realization they have to explain the origin of not just one life form, but literally dozens. Yes. Well, with these coral reefs, they were looking at the algae that are there. They're looking at the coral species all the way up to the fish. Clams, mollusks. So they were covering quite a broad range. And then they also broke it down into subspecies, just looking at the mollusks, just looking at the fish, just looking at the creatures that build the coral. And they said, we see it there too. So the paper basically proposes this is a universal principle. It's not something that's exceptional for short time scales or certain kinds of species. It seems like it's everywhere. Everywhere you look, whatever the time scale, whatever the species you look at, it's there. Well, this isn't well developed in our Origin of Life book. Basically, say in our Origin of Life book, we have observational evidence that you've got sulfate-reducing bacteria, oxic photosynthetic bacteria, anoxic photosynthetic bacteria, You've got chemoautotrophs operating. So it's quite a broad range of these bacterial species. What we've not looked at is why, but we do have an answer for why. Unless you've got those multiple bacterial species operating under different metabolic pathways, it will not sustain the chemical cycles that's necessary to keep all life going. Some of these bacteria will cycle sulfur, others cycle silicon, others cycle carbon, phosphorus, nitrogen. We talked about that, I think, last week, that you need all these cycles going. In fact, I got another paper here. I won't bother to talk about it because I want to get into Job 39 that actually talks about a whole new set of life forms they have found that's responsible for cycling silicon. Now, silicon is not something you have to have life. There are life forms that don't take advantage of silicon. However, it's important in the atmosphere, and that's critical to maintain these other cycles. So that's kind of our explanation why the origin of life are these dozens of different bacterial species with rather different metabolic pathways. It takes that to sustain all these chemical cycles. And you want lots of different life forms even with one particular cycle, because if something happens to one, you need something else to take over. Because if any one of these cycles gets disrupted, it's game over. And if something happens to, you know, one sulfate-reducing bacteria, you want lots of others that will be able to kick in. So that's the example there. Hey, let's get into the text. And we've been going through Job 39, talking about the second aspect of creation that the book of Job, or the end of the book of Job, deals with. Job 38 focused on the physical creation, Job 39 on the soulish creation, and basically takes us through a list of 9 or 10 different soulish animals that God creates, where God asks questions to the five assembled scientists that were living 3,500 to 4,000 years ago, Job and his four friends. And what we're noting here is that each of these animals that are mentioned is bringing up a particular apologetic point, making the argument that each of these animals plays a special role in the sustaining of human civilization and well-being. And also these creatures are manifesting characteristics that really cannot be explained from a naturalistic perspective. You know, how do you explain the goat? How do you explain the deer? And it gets into the reproduction of goats and deer and their behavior with respect to humanity. Last week we talked about the donkey, and just what an incredible creature the donkey is, how it can live under extremely harsh conditions, and it can run away from you, and it can come back 3 weeks later and fits right back into being part of your livelihood. And you know, if it escapes, it's going to do quite well. It's just as much at home in the wild as it is being domesticated, and it can switch from one to the other quite quickly. Unlike things like the oxen and the horse, which is going to be mentioned later, if you release a tamed ox or a tamed horse into the wild, it's going to have a more difficult time surviving than, say, a donkey. A donkey can live practically anywhere, where there's water or where there's no water, harsh conditions. And then we had a missionary here in the class, Cliff Peters, who talked about his life in the Bolivian highlands, and he says you don't find horses there, but you do see lots of donkeys. Donkeys can live under those conditions, the horses can't. And if a horse gets loose, it would be dead, but if a donkey gets loose, it survives quite well and you can recover it. And you know, the environment there is not conducive to keeping horses in a healthy state, but it is for donkeys. Therefore the people there have donkeys, they don't have horses. So these donkeys really do play a critical role. I mean, you might say, well, you know, why would God bother to create donkeys? Why not just create much more horses? But the donkeys really do fulfill a role, as we see here. Next, I'd like to address the paragraph starting in verse 9. It talks about the ox. And it says, will the wild ox consent to serve you? Will he stay by your manger at night? Can you hold him to the furrow with a harness? Will he till the valleys behind you? Will you rely on him for his great strength? Will you leave your heavy work to him? Can you trust him to bring in your grain and gather it to your threshing floor? Now keep in mind, the Lord here is talking to five men for whom oxen is a huge part of their financial well-being. By this time, oxen were being used for agriculture and being used in a very significant fashion. In fact, I think I mentioned to you a few weeks ago that the Domestication of oxen goes back about 7,000 or 8,000 years, and what I mean by that is significant domestication, where we have people having herds of hundreds and thousands of cows on one ranch. That dates back 7,000 or 8,000 years. Goats dates back 10,000 years, likewise sheep, but oxen are quite a bit later. And so these were creatures that these five people were well aware of, but then he asked the question, I mean, you all have tamed oxen that are part of your farms, so let me ask you the question, what about the wild ox? And, you know, he's basically bringing up the point that you're not going to be able to take an adult wild ox out there in the wild and to bring him onto your farm and have him do all this neat stuff for you. That's not going to happen. The best you can do is build a fence around a bunch of wild ox and let them run around, and then you kill a few of them for meat at some time down the road, but you're not going to have them draw or put a harness on them and have them plow your fields or have them move a cart for you or thresh grain. And you say, well, how do people do it? They do it by, in fact, people suggested that the domestication of the first cow was probably somebody finding a newborn cow that had been abandoned by its mother, and they raised that newborn cow from that point forward. And what happens at that point is the cow will bond with the human that's caring for it. And then that human is able to get that cow to do virtually anything it wants. In fact, there's a verse that talks about this elsewhere. Let me see. I think it's... here it is. Isaiah 1:3. I mean, we're talking about donkeys, now we're talking about ox. Isaiah 1:3 makes this point. The ox knows his master. The donkey, his owner's manger. In other words, how we relate to donkeys is that they don't so much form a relationship with us, they form a relationship with the feed bin that we give them, okay? So they know where their source of food is. And so, you know, we can motivate the donkey because that donkey knows, hey, if I stick around this person, I'm going to get fed and I'm going to get water. I'll get taken care of. By contrast, it says the ox knows his master. And so when you raise a cow from birth and up to adulthood, that cow will bond with you, and you literally will be treated like the mother of that cow, and it will form a relationship. Now, I have an uncle in Nova Scotia who's been raising cows for decades, and he has a reputation in his town that he makes pets of every cow that he raises. He's got lots of cows, but every one of them knows my uncle. In fact, when I visited him for the first time in 1970, we drove up to the farm, and he was driving the truck, and it's like every single cow would run to the fence when they saw him. And then at night they all came and they wanted to be stroked and petted by my uncle. And so that's the whole point there. They know the master. And but he says, you know, some of the farmers out here, they just grab the cows, put a fence around them and let them run wild. But I find I get better meat if I raise them like this. So, I mean, in terms of getting a cow that can thresh wheat or plow for you or draw a cart for you, you really have to have that cow bond with you. That's the way it works. Well, the whole point here, you know, God has designed these oxen to behave that way, and he's designed the donkey to behave a different way, and there's practicality for both of them. Now, you might say, well, how come oxen, where people waited so long to take domesticate oxen, they're much bigger. I mean, if a goat gets into trouble, you can kind of do something with it. It's hard to do that with a 1,000-pound creature, especially one that's got big horns. And, you know, if it's not raised from birth, it's not going to follow your commands. And so it takes a lot more care. But the big advantage of an ox, in fact, as you go throughout the Bible, it'd be interesting just to do a concordant study of ox. You'll see that there's hundreds of references to ox and oxen in the Bible. And there's a lot in the Levitical law about the ox and how, you know, if you do something to somebody else's ox, that's a really big problem. And the whole point about the ox is that God has designed it in such a way that if you're poor and you have just one cow, that cow can really do a lot to sustain your family. In fact, in India, that's often the case. The family will have just one cow, and that one cow sustains the family. You know, a 1,000-pound cow can provide milk for the family and cheese. When you kill it, you've got leather. When you kill it, you've got meat. And so you really only need one or two to keep the family going, whereas you're talking goats, you've got to have a whole bunch of them. And so organization becomes more of a problem. If you're talking just one cow, it's easy to raise that cow from birth and have a form a relationship where that cow will follow you everywhere you go. In fact, friends of mine who live in India say that the cows actually come right into the homes with the families. That cow just wants to be around the people all the time. And so, the cow is a member of the family. They're sacred. But as they die, they'll take advantage of the leather. So, but the whole point is, milk and cheese come from that cow, and it's out there eating grass. It eats stuff that the rest of the family doesn't eat. That's another advantage of a cow. It doesn't compete with you for food. Whereas a goat is out there eating everything that you like to eat. The cow won't do that. And so, yeah. Right. But the donkey's a little different. And the whole point of this chapter is God has created these soulish animals. Every one of them with the capacity to relate to us, but each one relates to us in a different way than the others. And the challenge, I think, from the evolutionists is, what you're trying to explain here is how these different behaviors and capacities to relate to human beings could evolve by chance. And I think that's what these paragraphs are all about, is that God is saying to these five assembled men, have you considered the ostrich? Have you considered the ox, the donkey, the deer, the goat, the horse? These are really unusual creatures. How can you explain it unless I've designed them specifically to manifest these attributes so that they can relate to you in this way? As I look at all the creatures that are discussed here, each one relates to us in a manner that's quite different from the other. And so the evolutionist has got to explain the by-chance appearance of all these different styles of behavior relating to human beings. It also tells me as I go through all of this that these creatures seem to be designed in these different ways to facilitate human civilization activity. As I mentioned, we get down to the horse. That, to me, is the strangest creature of all to explain. This big animal that you can ride on that doesn't mind having arrows and spears thrown at it. I mean, how do you explain that arising by chance? An animal that actually loves to charge into battle. And all these other animals that are listed here don't do that. Try getting on a donkey and charging into battle with a donkey. A donkey sees those arrows, it's going to head in the opposite direction. But a horse doesn't do that. And I don't understand how you could possibly explain that behavior from an evolutionary perspective. Survival of the fittest would not predict the behavior of a horse. Yeah, they will. So will the ox, for that matter. So a lot of these creatures will do that. Goats will do that. But a horse is really an incredible animal that you can ride on top of it with a bunch of armor and actually charge into an army of where they've got thousands of spears and arrows and all flying at you, and that horse keeps going and actually seems to enjoy it. Right. The rider is scared, but the horse isn't. So what's with this horse? There's certain things that wouldn't have happened in human history if it weren't for the horse, and I think that's true of every animal that's here. We would not be where we were if it weren't for cows. And cows really do play a critical role. Over here. One reason I would argue that perhaps not is that a pattern you see throughout the Bible when it's addressing creation is it seems to stick to that stuff that's able to touch people's living at all times. As I go through the Bible, I see no mention of dinosaurs. Not that dinosaurs aren't important. However, it would have no point of context for people living earlier than 1800. Therefore, I would argue that's why it's not in the Bible, because the Bible is designed to be a book that communicates to all generations. It doesn't mean that there can't be a passage in the Bible that deals with scientific issues that would not be fully appreciated unless you lived in the 21st century. We went through that in Job 38. It's loaded with stuff that only now do we understand. On the other hand, all of Job 38, I would argue, would make sense to someone living 4,000 years ago. They wouldn't understand it to the degree we do, but it would make sense to them. They'd say, oh yeah, I know what you're talking about. So I think for the text to bring up, say, bipedal primates, Job and his friends would say, Lord, what are you talking about? We've never heard of these bipedal primates. But there are people who read the text as saying, oh no, we believe that the Bible really does contain points of reference that would apply to only some people, not to all people. That's just kind of my preference. And I see that as a pattern throughout the whole of the Bible. Everything in the Bible has some relevance to all readers. And if you dig into it deeper, it has relevance for people who know a little more about history and science than people living thousands of years ago. The other thing I would point out about that argument is it seems to me that this contrast between the wild or difficult to tame animals and those that are domesticatable is in the context of long-legged quadrupeds. I actually found that mentioned in several lexicons on those words, that these are the long-legged land mammals. And in that sense, the creatures that creepeth along the ground, perhaps that's making a contrast between long-legged mammals and short-legged mammals. Maybe. I mean, it's a possibility. And that seems to me the simplest way to read that text. And that kind of raises the point, why would God mention short-legged land mammals? Well, one thing I've discovered talking to zoologists is that these short-legged land mammals factored much heavily into our agricultural economy than they do now. I mean, today we kind of focus on the big ones. But, you know, even when I was being raised as a kid up in Canada, you saw lots of chinchilla farms. That was really big business 50 years ago. Now that we got PETA running around, it's not quite so popular to have chinchilla coats. And what are these other things they have? These little white creatures that make these beautiful... There was a lot of that going on when I was raised in Canada. These are all these short-legged rodents that we raise for fur. And if you go back far enough, they're also raised for meat. In fact, I think you can still go in the supermarket and get rabbit and use that for meat. And I think what's going on in Genesis 1 is God's kind of mentioning the panoply of mammals that he created for our benefit. In that sense, I would ask the question, how would I classify mammals in such a category that you'd have three neat little ways? That's one way to do it, not the only way. Well, you will find that in Psalm 104. Genesis 1 kind of focuses on the swarms of small sea creatures, the sheres. And then it gets into the birds and mammals generically, fifth creation day, then sixth creation day, three specialized kinds of land mammals. And frankly, I'm comfortable with a minimalist view. This is just God simply describing three categories of land mammals that will cohabit the planet with us, that will factor into sustaining our civilization technology. There could be more to it than that, and there's certainly more when you get into the other creation accounts. Okay, back to, well, we're running out of time, back to the ox here. just to remind you again that one of the reasons, by the way, oxen are difficult to domesticate compared to cows and sheep and even horses, as we're going to run into next. But one of the real advantages that oxen served is that they forestalled the onset of the next ice age. I think I talked about that about 3 weeks ago here. There's a new research paper making the point that was the widespread domestication of cows that raised the methane level in the atmosphere to a high enough degree that it literally forestalled the next ice age. The next ice age should have begun 5,000 years ago. But because the human species actually got aggressive in domesticating cows 7,000-8,000 years ago, this literally forestalled the next ice age, and it's still forestalling the next ice age. And by the way, it's quite dramatic. Before we domesticated cows, the atmosphere had 450 parts of methane per billion. And now it has close to, a little more than 700 parts per billion of methane. And cows are responsible for a lot of that. Another big factor is all this rice that we're irrigating. But cows are a big factor. And one of the things we did was we not only produced a lot more cows, so a lot more methane, we began to breed cows in such a way that they produced more milk and more meat, but it also produced a lot more methane. So that's one of the things that's keeping this planet warm enough to forestall the next ice age. Yeah. In that context, yes. Okay. Or use more leather, I mean. Or eat more cheese, I mean, whatever. Especially the milk production has been a huge factor in increasing the methane production of cows. Now, if you want to get 80 quarts of milk out of a cow, you're going to get a lot of methane along with that milk. So, yeah. There you go. That's another great bumper sticker. Okay, that may be a good place to close the class. All right, so next time we'll talk about the ostrich. The ostrich, again, is a really strange bird that we're going to look at. And it's mentioned only one other place in Scripture. You're going to find it in Lamentations, of all places. It talks about this ostrich. And it's referred to as the heartless creature. But we're going to see that that heartlessness really does factor into humans being able to launch their civilization and technology. And, by the way, is a good reason why the ostrich is so heartless towards its young. It's the only way its young would ever survive. So if it was caring towards its young, then it wouldn't make it. Okay, let's bow for prayer. Father in heaven, it's just incredible to read this text in Job 39 and recognize how amazingly designed each of these animals are. Not only for them to survive in their environment and be productive as creatures, but also to factor in to sustaining a human civilization and technology, and particularly launching it and keeping this planet ideal for a large, widespread human population. Lord, may we not take these creatures for granted and help us to maintain the appropriate historical perspective to see how valuable they were in getting us to where we are today. If it weren't for you creating these animals, we wouldn't have all this civilization and technology around us. So we give thanks, Lord. And Lord, I pray too that you'd enable us to use this study in the book of Job to be a point of contact with our non-Christian friends and relatives and associates. Lord, that they too would be amazed at your glory in creation and your righteousness in creation. So I pray, Father, you give each one of us opportunities to witness and to share. And Lord, I pray for our team. As about 8 of us are going to Chicago, Lord, I pray that you would bless our speaking, that you would bless Ken Samples and Fuzz Rana and Krista Bontrager as they speak on different venues throughout the Chicago area. And Father, I pray that, we would see a rich harvest of people coming to know you as Lord and Savior, and of Christians growing in their sanctified relationship with you. In Jesus' name, amen.